Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Money Podcast for the weekend of April 4th, 2014. This week on the show, stop being such a cheapskate. We're going to turn some of our usual personal finance conversations upside down and tell you when it's better to spend a little more. Plus, convenience has a cost. What if screens and apps and technology are taking something from you? Put that phone down and listen. But we're going to start with jobs. This week, the Labor Department told us that the unemployment rate stayed flat at 6.7%, and the economy added 192,000 jobs last month. A decent report, but not fabulous. It got us wondering, though, about how Americans feel about the job market. We reached out to Heidi Shierholz. She studies the labor market at the Economic Policy Institute, a left-leaning think tank in Washington. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Do you think people are more confident in the security of their jobs today than they were a year ago?
Yeah, that's a fine question. I believe so. Today, they have reason to be slightly more secure than they were a year ago, but not that much. What we see in the labor market is, you know, regardless of what measure we're looking at, what we saw is that we sort of fell off a cliff in 2008 and 2009. And since then, we've been making steady improvement, but it's been really slow. That's been several years ago. So every year we see a modest gains, but it's just not coming that fast. So I think people in the labor market have a lot of reason to feel pretty insecure right now, but it's slowly getting better.
When you look at when people decide to quit a job, what does that tell you about the labor market?
It actually gives us a lot of information about the strength of job opportunities. One thing that I think is a little bit counterintuitive about this measure of labor market strength is when you first hear the idea of quits, it may resonate as not a good thing,
right?
But it actually signals something good in the labor market. When job opportunities are really strong, people will quit a job and move on to a job that's better for them. It's one of the key ways people move up in the American labor market. Quits are still much lower than they were before this all began, but they're slowly increasing.
I want to ask you to define just a piece of jargon that you and I have both used. It's economist speak jargon. We are using the word quits as a noun. Basically, it's economist for people quitting their jobs, right?
Yeah, it really is exactly what it sounds like. When I say quits, I mean the number of people who have voluntarily quit their jobs. So layoffs are the other example of separations. You can have a separation from your job because you either got laid off or you voluntarily quit. And so when economists talk about quits, they're talking about those people who voluntarily quit their jobs.
Let's say you're looking around at the labor market right now. What do we know about what jobs and what industries are growing?
Right now, what we're seeing in our current weak labor market is disproportionate growth in low-wage industries. So you're seeing a lot of growth in restaurants and bars. You're seeing a lot of growth in retail jobs. You're seeing a lot of growth in temporary help services. Those are all pretty low-wage jobs. One point of optimism I have is I don't think we're turning into a nation where we only have retail workers and temp workers and restaurant workers. I don't think we're going to continue to see that trend forever.
So what comes next?
What happens when you have a labor market that's as weak as the one that we're in? It just is always true that low-wage jobs tend to grow disproportionately. And one of the reasons for that is there's always people who want to hire somebody for extremely low wages, potentially, you know, not a steady schedule, maybe bad working conditions. But when job opportunities are strong, people don't have to take those jobs. But at a time like this, when job opportunities are pretty weak, desperate workers will snap up whatever's out there. And so you see this disproportionate growth in lower wage jobs when the labor market is weak. When we do start seeing the recovery kick in a little stronger than it is right now, I think we'll start to see more broad-based job growth. And the jobs that come back will look pretty much like the ones that were lost.
I'm curious about the psychology of some of this, because if you are thinking about what's next, or if you feel stuck in a job, where does that come from? Does that come from, you know, hearing about the bad economy on the news? Does that come from trying to stretch your own pocketbook? Or does that come from, you know, looking at your coworkers and thinking, oh, I know there's only space for one person to get promoted? You know, how does the psychology of this all shake out?
One thing that we do see is that this happens a lot with young workers. Mm. As you start out your career, you're much more mobile from job to job. There's a lot more jumping around from job to job as people really hone in on what they really want to do, what they're really good at, what they have the best chance for advancement in. That happens a lot when you're a younger worker, less and less as you get older, but it still can really matter. It's still a way that, you know, prime age and older workers can see advancement. But I think it's a case of you look around, you say, I know what I do, I know what I like, I know what I can do, and I could find a better match somewhere else.
Heidi Shierholz is an economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you so much.
You are very welcome.
On an earlier show, we heard from guests who supported raising the federal minimum wage. It now stands at $7.25. There's a proposal in Congress to raise it to $10.10. Our next guest doesn't want to raise it. He's the president and the CEO of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry, which represents businesses in that state. Gene Barr, welcome to Marketplace Money.
Thank you for the invitation to come on.
Tell me why you are opposed to this proposed change to the minimum wage.
What we believe is, and this is based on our experiences, that the minimum wage increase proposed is not only highly inefficient, but is actually harmful to those people who most need these entry-level jobs. If you think about it, a much better way of trying to help these people would be, for example, increasing the earned income tax credit at the federal side, because in that way, we're all participating a little bit and trying to make things better for the people who truly need it. That is, people starting out, struggling, et cetera, versus with a minimum wage, what you wind up doing is penalizing the employers who are trying to hire folks who need this first foot in the door, who in many cases, most cases actually, are small businesses.
We had a gentleman from the Small Business Majority on the show, and they've got a poll, and their poll had 67% of small business owners supportive of a minimum wage increase. What would you say to that?
I would have to see the question that was asked. I'd have to see who their membership is, who they asked. That does not go with what we know. It does not go with, for example, what the Congressional Budget Office said, which is this will cost 500,000 jobs or more. We know from our members, because we polled them the last time we had a minimum wage increase, we know what they had to do. They had to reduce hours. They had to lay off. They had to prevent hiring in order to keep their labor costs under control. And we already know from talking to our small business members what they'll have to do this time. And the numbers are pretty much the same. They will have to take steps to keep their costs in line, particularly as we've not come out of this recession yet. So it really does put a tremendous burden on small businesses. And again, these are the people who are hiring our kids, hiring the people who need that foot in the door to get started, to learn what it takes to succeed in their careers.
We have seen tremendous growth when you look at monthly jobs reports coming from the Labor Department in low-wage jobs. Indeed, that has been a real change in the economy over the last, say, 5 years. That's where the growth is. And we're not talking about kids. We're talking about, say, people with children, with dependents. What's wrong with giving them another $2.85?
Well, that's a great question, assuming they get to keep that job. The reality is, let's look at the demographics a bit. The reality is that most people who work minimum wage jobs are part-time. About 80% do not have kids. Now, let's be honest. They're not all kids. There are people who truly need that assistance. but about more than half of them are in households where the household income is above $50,000, which is a crucial number because that's the average take-home for a small business person. About a third of the minimum wage earners are in households where the household income is above $75,000. So you're talking about a rather unfair situation, asking in many cases a small business person who takes home maybe $40,000 or $50,000, giving a $3 an hour raise to perhaps a high school student, college student who lives in a household where the income is $75,000 or $100,000.
Let's talk macroeconomics for a second. We know that folks on the lower end of the economic spectrum tend to be spenders, not savers, largely because they have to be. Isn't there some wisdom that would say, well, gosh, increasing the minimum wage might pump some more money into the economy overall because that's going to go right back out the door to, say, those small businesses, you know, on food, on clothes, on gas, and the like?
Well, first, you got to hope you're the small business that gets the recipient of that. But let's look at that more in detail. I've heard from proponents of this that, one, there are no job losses associated with a minimum wage increase. I think you've heard the same, I'm sure. And two, many of the proponents talk about what you've said. That is, this is an injection of wealth and of dollars into the economy. Now, if that were true, that is, you don't lose jobs with a minimum wage increase and it puts money in the economy. If those were both true, why would we stop at 10-10? Why would we not put more money in the economy and make a minimum wage increase of, say, $20 or $50 an hour? The reality is implicit in the fact that they don't propose that. They know that it harms jobs because this takes money. The money that is paid to these people has to come from somewhere, and it comes out of the pocket of somebody who, in most cases, more likely than not, is a small business person.
So your ideal solution would be an expansion of the earned income tax credit?
It's a number of things, and that's a great question. One is looking at programs like EITC. Two is looking at how we get these people the job skills, the training that they need in order to advance themselves in. Because in reality, the people who are most hurt by minimum wage are the people trying to get their foot in the door. So we need to do a better job as a society of getting these people in the talents, the skills, the abilities so they can get that foot in the door. That's how we're going to move things forward.
Gene Barr is the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Chamber of Business and Industry. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you for the opportunity. Really appreciate it.
Coming up, personal finance expert Jill Schlesinger joins me to take your calls. And later, when being cheap costs you more.
If you value having a partner, if you value finding someone and spending the rest of your life with someone, you want to spend a little bit of money. Don't take your date to Wendy's. Don't take your date to McDonald's. Don't ask your date to split on a pizza. So if you're cheap, lie about it or at least put it off. You know, spend a little bit of money if you value finding someone in the future.
That's on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Now's the part of the show where we take your calls. And joining me today is personal finance expert and the host of Jill on Money, CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Nice to see you again, Jill.
It's great to be here.
So our first caller is Karen in Portland, Maine. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
So I gather that you've got some pretty hefty student loan debt. Is that correct?
Yes.
What's the number?
Oh, boy. So between my undergrad and my graduate, I, for some reason, with very little kind of financial guidance in my life, I chose two very expensive schools and walked away with my MSW, my Master's in Social Work, with $135,000.
Okay. And about how much are you making in income right now?
Right now, I am a public school social worker, so I'm in the Portland School District as a social worker, and I pull in about 42 or 47,000.
Okay, and the the payment plan or the rehabilitation plan that you're on for your student loans. Lay that out for us.
Well, after I graduated in 2009 with my MSW, and after that, I was having a very difficult time finding work in this field that paid really anything. So I just kind of had a bunch of odd jobs in Portland. I was a waitress, did a bunch of things that I was a nanny. And in all of that, I still wasn't able to make my payments. So I more or less ignored them, which is the terrible thing to do. But just out of survival, I just was ignoring them. And then they all went into a very delinquent state. And about a year ago, I started to get myself in a better financial situation, and I was able to contact them and make payments. But at that point, it was too late. So they were in what's called garnishment. So they take out a chunk of my paycheck. And then on top of that, to get out of garnishment, I have to be rehabilitating them for 9 months, which is, I think I'm at like month 4 or 5 right now. And I'm making payments of close to $300 in rehabilitation. And then on top of that, they're taking out about $750 a month from my pay. So it's between $900 and $1,000 a month I'm paying just to get these private and federal loans out of garnishment and in a delinquent place, so that come September, I can my credit will be in much better standing.
The moment in which you graduated is something that economists and people who have reported on this call the lost generation. It's people who graduated into the height of the recession, when it was really hard to find a job, to pay back your loans, to do all of that stuff.
Yeah.
I'm going to turn you over to Jill, who is sometimes tough, but
not now.
But not now, because like, I can see her doing the math on a piece
trying,
of paper in the studio.
It's so hard. And so, as you said, you can't go back. You can't go make a different decision today based on 5 years ago. Well, you know, gee, if I had your high school senior self in front of me, we would talk about, like, gee, don't go into debt and don't borrow more than what you think your first year salary is going to be. But we're beyond that. So I actually there's not a lot to do right this second, which is, you know, on some level kind of good. There's no decision here. You've got to get this thing back on track.
Yep.
You already have a mortgage payment, essentially, or a second rent payment at that $1,000 a month. And so what I'm wondering is, what happens in 9 months for you? What is it that you want to happen? And what's actually the question here that we need to try to figure out for you?
Well, so come September, when my private and my government loans will be out of rehabilitation, I'm hoping, you know, one of the questions I have is, well, then what? So how do I not make this mistake again? What sort of income-based payment plan do I get myself on? I know, being a social worker and being a nonprofit, there's a lot of resources out there for us. I just am too busy taking care of other people to know what those resources are. So I am curious about what would be the next step for myself in the fall. You know, I guess that's the biggest question. You know, also on the stovetop, we have, I'm expecting a baby in October.
Oh, congratulations.
So, thanks.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that's kind of a whole nother thing that is on my husband and myself's plate. It wasn't necessarily unplanned. We were letting nature take its course, and nature decided now. So that's kind of another financial situation that we need to sort out in the fall. And then we also were working with a lender in the Portland area to get a mortgage for the fall. Once my credit, Pete, my husband, has fantastic credit. I think he's up around 730. So we were just waiting for my credit to be in a good place for us to tag team a mortgage.
And what does he do for a living?
He owns his own recording studio, so he's a sound engineer. He does fairly well for being self-employed. Again, it's a little irregular in terms of when his income comes in, but when it does come in, it's great and it's lucrative. So together, our joint income is, I think we just filed our taxes, and I think we claimed like $86,000. So it's not great.
And you, when you say $86,000, you mean at the bottom right hand corner, the adjusted gross income of that front page of your return said $86,000.
Yes, and you know, I
so
think,
I presume that I'm going to presume that because he's a small business owner, he's writing a lot of things off.
Exactly.
And so, okay, let me just jump in for one second here. I don't think the house is a great idea right now.
Okay.
I really don't. Only because it's just another financial burden, and there's no rush to do that. I mean, you're going to come back and say to me, what about rising interest rates? And I'm going to say, we got bigger fish to fry.
Okay, but so my quick question with that is, because we are expecting, I mean, the house that we live in now is great. We've been in there for 3 years. It's enough space for a newborn, but it's definitely not enough space for like a one-year-old.
Okay. So maybe you go find another rental that give you a little bit more space.
Okay.
But first of all, where's the down payment coming from for a mortgage?
I know we don't have that.
And like, why would you make yourself crazy like that? I wouldn't even worry about it. I think that's how old are you?
I'm 31.
Oh, you're so young.
Oh, you're young.
So, you know, you're very young.
Very hopeful.
You don't feel young to yourself, but you are young.
Trust us, you're young.
Okay.
Take it from the older sisters here on
so
the other end of the line.
So I can turn this boat around.
Excuse me, you are a social worker, so you know that change is possible, but recognition and acknowledgement is like part of the process. You're already there.
Yeah.
So what you need to do is you got to start investigating the various income-based options. You should talk about perhaps, are there any programs with employers that would help you? Maybe it's not your school district, but another.
Well, I'm also curious if you're working for a public school district or anything that involves the state, you might want to look into public service loan forgiveness because there are certainly programs
that are available.
That are available there.
But I think that once, you know, you're going to get that, but at the end of the day, after you look at everything, you're still going to have a big fat payment.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what you should be thinking about is we need to move into a place where it gives us some breathing room for a few years, where we can get, you know, through 0 to 3 years old with a kid before you have the second kid. You can start crunching down those payments and really working hard. And at the same time, I just want to warn you, because your husband is self-employed, it ain't easy qualifying for a mortgage when you're self-employed because you've got to show a lot of history and all those fun things you do to reduce your tax liability as a small business owner hurts you for the mortgage application process. So if you're really thinking about, you know, buying a home, I would be thinking about, okay, that's a 3 to 5 year decision.
Okay.
You want to be doing that as you're making more money. You guys should talk to just a mortgage lender now to talk a little bit about what the composition of his income and what it needs to look like to qualify for a mortgage. And you know what? And don't be in such a rush. You guys have a lot on your plate right now. So one thing at a time. You got to have this baby. That sounds hard enough. I'm stopping right there. That's done. And then you got to pay down your student loans. That all right. So that's plenty to contend with for today.
Okay.
Karen, thank you so much for calling. And really, congratulations.
Thank you. Bye.
All right, Jill. We're going to take a quick break and then come back. Will you stick around?
Sounds great.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and I'm here with personal finance expert and CBS News business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Our next caller is Elisa in San Leandro, California. Hi, Elisa.
Hi, Lizzie. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. I understand that you are the beneficiary of a series of Series E bonds from your mom. Tell us about those.
Yes, my mother purchased these bonds in May 1978. They have a face value of $1,000, and they're purchased for $750. And I understand they earned interest and stopped earning interest as of May 2008. It's a 30-year bond, I guess. Mm-hmm. So I was able to redeem a few after my mom passed away, and suddenly I have a $7,033.60 interest to claim on my income taxes for 2013. That's a lot of taxable interest, and I'm just wondering if there's any workaround or...
So you've, hi, Elisa, this is Jill, and you've already redeemed these, correct?
I've redeemed some of them. I still have some in my safe deposit box.
And so the $7,000, that's what you've already redeemed? That's the taxable liability that you've already redeemed?
That's the taxable liability for two of the bonds.
Okay. And what remains, by the way? How much is, what's left?
I think I have four bonds left. So that would be about $14,000 of interest.
Okay. So as you have now found out in the most unappealing way, this is exactly how Series E and Double E and Series I bonds, the inflation-linked bonds, work. We buy them at a discount, and then they mature, but you never get an interest payment. In other words, mom didn't just collect the interest. It wasn't like she got a check sent from the government. It just added to the total value of the bond. And if you want to sound super smart, just talk to your friends and tell them about how those bonds accreted in value.
Absolutely.
Just rip that out. Just bring that out for a little excitement.
Yeah.
That is the nerdiest word we've ever had on this show.
Really? Accretion. It's awesome. So meaning that, you know, the value of the bond builds up. It's all interest. Mm-hmm. And when you redeem that bond, all of that interest is taxable. So here's the bad news. You will not be able to avoid paying taxes on that.
Okay.
There is no way. Forget it.
Okay.
There's nothing to do. Once you redeem it, government is going to be sending you the 1099, and you're going to claim it, and you're going to pay the tax due on that $7,000. That's the deal. I know. I'm sorry.
Okay.
So what about the rest of the $14,000? Tell us a little bit more about your life. I don't love the idea about bonds sitting in a safe deposit box earning no interest. On the other hand, I know you're not excited about going to pay taxes. So can we maybe space out the redemption of this, of these other bonds, to make sure you stay within a current tax bracket? Or,
well, I hate to admit this, I don't know what tax bracket I'm in, but I earn very little money. I work part time.
How much?
I earn $12,000 a year.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
I mean, $12,000. And
okay.
I get Social Security as a widow, so that's another $1,000. That's $12,000 there. So that's $24,000.
Okay.
And I have a little bit of some stock that I was gifted, and so the principal issues are worth, shares are worth $21,000. That's sitting in the, that's in my savings, my safe deposit box, and that earns about $700 interest a year.
Okay.
So does that tell you what you...
Yes, I'm going to tell you.
I have to say also, I do live beyond my means. It's just, there's...
How are you doing that? Do you have a bunch of debt?
I have a bunch of debt. I'm so
embarrassed. Oh, wait a minute. You mean you just gave me the classic thing, which is, let me just tell you about one half of my balance sheet, but not the other half. So we got the assets.
It actually seems like maybe there are other questions that are lurking behind the question.
You know.
How much credit card debt do you have?
I have $7,000 in credit card debt. That's it.
Isn't that funny? $7,000 redemption, $7,000 in debt.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain... Interesting.
There's some symmetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What'd you do with that $7,000 when you redeemed the bonds?
I did about $6,000 worth of home improvements.
Okay.
So, to me, it wasn't like buying purses and shoes. It really was making my home a better place to live.
Okay. I love that rationalization. That's good.
And I hope to die here. You know, it's...
Okay.
So...
I don't want you to die yet. Let's figure this out first. So the bonds that you, when you claimed those, redeemed those bonds, was that in tax year 2013?
Yes, correct.
Okay. So here we are in 14. By redeeming those bonds, you will not bump up into a new tax bracket.
Okay.
Okay? You will not. I think it's under $34,000 as an individual, something like that.
Okay.
It may even be more. But so here's what you're going to do, however. You can't keep piling on credit card debt because you don't have enough money to do that, right?
Right.
So this year, what I think you may want to do is you want to take maybe, you know, probably, let's say, two more of those bonds, maybe three more, and you're going to redeem them, and you're going to pay off your credit card debt.
That does sound gorgeous. That does
Doesn't
sound
it?
Gorgeous, yeah.
Oh,
just
my God.
Because that's less money going out every single month to
Correct.
Pay, the, you know, the, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so we're going to do that.
Okay.
Now, the thing is, when you redeemed those bonds, did they give you a chance to, I don't remember how this works
no,
with the federal
to prepay
government.
You
didn't get, you didn't, okay.
No.
So what you're going to do is, you know, you're going to take three of the bonds, you're going to redeem them, and keep a few $1,000s in the bank.
Okay.
Because you're going to have to pay taxes on that.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
And then pay off that credit card. And by the way, even if you don't have enough money in cash because you went nutty, because you went to Nordstrom or something wacky like that before next tax season, next year, a year from now, you can save that last bond and redeem that to pay your tax bill. So you got the game plan here?
Yes, I'm going to cash in some bonds, pay off my credit cards, which feels wonderful. And then, quite honestly, I would be eligible to get a, what do you call that thing, a home equity line of credit, so if I ever needed to buy, you know, 6 gallons of paint or some flooring.
Yeah. You know what I might do? Yes, you could do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I would do that. What I would do is I would take the monthly amount you were paying towards the credit card and just put that automatically in your bank account and start building up your emergency reserve fund.
Again, yes. Yes.
Right? Oh, my God, another satisfied customer.
I'm happy.
All right. Well, just be careful out there, will you?
Oh, Jill, thank you so much. And Lucy, too. Thank
you. You're so welcome.
Good luck.
Alrighty.
Thank you, Elisa. Jill Schlesinger, CBS News business analyst and the host of Jill on Money, wearing today fabulous green suede sneakers. It is awesome, as always, to have you here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And it's always fun to hang out with you, Lizzie.
Just ahead, going from theater geek to TV gold with Simpsons producer Michael Price.
I remember going to see a production of Man of La Mancha at a community theater in North Brunswick, New Jersey. And the guy who was playing Don Quixote, he's a doctor during the day. I remember my mom leaning over to me and pointing to the thing and saying, "See, he's a doctor during the day. And he does his acting at night." Very nicely and gently saying, "That might be something you want to do."
That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. This being a personal finance show, we talk a lot about saving money, how to put it away for your retirement or your kids' education, a rainy day. Today, though, we're going to challenge that mindset and examine a few moments where saving money up front might not be the right call, because it can cost you down the road. Something our next guest frames as when being cheap doesn't pay off. He's Daryl Perinata, and he's a reporter for MyBankTracker.com. Hi, Daryl.
Hi, Lizzie. Thank you for having me.
What is the difference in your mind between saving money and being cheap?
So the difference between saving money and being cheap, really, it's kind of a fine line, right? So I'm going to refer to people who save money as being frugal people. And frugal people, they save because they usually have an end goal in mind, right? So they have some sort of financial goal, whether that's saving for retirement, whether they want to buy a new home, whatever it is, they're saving for that goal. Whereas somebody who's cheap, they just look at prices. They don't want to spend money at all. They want to spend the cheapest amount on the item or service, and it doesn't matter that it might hurt or harm their quality of life.
So what are some examples of things where being cheap in your mind, doesn't pay off.
So a great example of somebody who's cheap is someone who doesn't spend money on their health care. They might skip out on a visit to their doctor. And in the long run, that's actually going to cost you money because you might have a disease that is not detected early enough and you might cause problems. Another example is not taking your car to the mechanic. Well, a few months down the line, when you're driving down the highway and you have an issue with your car, it's going to end up costing you more money. And so being cheap and buying the cheapest service or product, it's not always going to pay off. Another example is buying in bulk. When I was young, my grandma and my uncle, they used to love taking me to Costco, and I used to love trying all the samples. I love that. And I also remember my grandma buying the big jugs of spaghetti, the 60-ounce jugs of spaghetti sauce.
Oh, totally. I bought the giant jug of mayonnaise. Yeah.
Well, did you eat all that mayonnaise, Lizzie?
No, of course not.
And that's the problem with buying things in bulk, is that sometimes you don't actually use all of the product, and then you're actually wasting money.
So one of the other things you have written about here is DIY, do-it-yourself projects, where I admit I have tried some DIY plumbing, some of which worked out, like I can change a shower head, but you have some advice in here that DIY is an area to be careful with.
It is an area to be careful with. So did it end up costing you more money doing DIY, Lizzie?
Yeah, when I tried a sink unclogging thing that did not go as planned.
No. So that's a perfect example. And I actually was reading a recent survey that said 70% of Americans prefer to go the DIY route when it comes to making home improvements, right? And that's a really big percentage. You really need to think about how much money it's costing you and how much time it will take to undertake these projects. So before you take out the hammers and you start a DIY project for your house, you should ask yourself three questions. First, do I know what I'm doing? If the answer is no, in your case, if you didn't fix you need to be honest with yourself. If you don't know what you're doing, don't DIY. Could I hurt myself or my house? Another question you probably should have asked yourself, Lizzie, because you did end up costing yourself more money. And finally, is it worth my time? So you need to learn when DIY needs to D-I-E die.
All right. Setting my own foolishness aside, what are some of the wackiest things you have seen people do to try to save money?
I know people who might drive 30, 40 miles out of their way to get cheaper gas. You know, gas is a tricky thing. Nobody wants to spend a lot of money on gas. You know, I live in Los Angeles. I drive to work every day. I want to save on gas, too. Let me give you an example. So let's say the largest difference in gas prices in your area at any given time is 7 or 8 cents a gallon, right? Mm-hmm. So the average sedan fill up, and it might run about 15 or so gallons. So if you actually do the math, you're only saving $1.20. And if you're driving out of your way 30, 40 miles, you're actually losing money. So my advice to people who want to save on gas would be download a mobile app on your phone to see where the cheapest gas prices are, or drive around in your neighborhood and take stock of what stations offer the cheapest gas.
What are a couple of things that you should not skimp on?
If you think about it, you spend half your time in a mattress and half your time in shoes, right?
Yeah.
So something that you shouldn't skimp on is a good mattress and a good pair of shoes. A good mattress, it might cost you about $1,000, but in the end, that's worth it. And really, it's all about value, right? What kinds of things do you value? What kinds of things might improve your quality of life?
Daryl, you wrote that going the cheapskate route is a no-no if you are on a date.
Yes. All of the cheapskates out there, listen up. You need to spend a little bit of money. If you value having a partner, if you value finding someone and spending the rest of your life with someone, you want to spend a little bit of money. Don't take your date to Wendy's. Don't take your date to McDonald's. Don't ask your date to split on a pizza. So if you're cheap, lie about it, or at least put it off. You know, spend a little bit of money if you value finding someone in the future.
On the other hand, I went to a free museum once with a date, and that was lovely.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, there are lots of free things that you could do. Cook a meal at home, take your date to the park, walk on the beach. You don't have to spend a lot of money on a date.
It's all about that value equation, right? Finding ways
Absolutely.
To maximize your time and show that person you care.
Absolutely.
Daryl Perinata is a reporter for MyBankTracker.com. Daryl, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Lizzie.
We all have our ways of spending too much money and spending too little. So, all right, how does your particular cheapness cost you money? Come on, swallow your pride. Let us know. Visit marketplacemoney.org. You can write us an email, leave us a comment, record a voicemail, or hit us up on Facebook or tweet us at LiveMoney. This is Marketplace Money from APM. If there's a cost to being a cheapskate, you could also argue that there's a price to be paid for convenience. The shortcuts made possible by the latest in technology, Google Glass, food delivery on my phone, Twitter, Amazon, Tinder, whatever, can take a toll on everything from our waistlines to our ability to pay attention or have uninterrupted conversation. So we're going to have one with Tim Wu. He's been writing about the idea of technological evolution. He's a professor at Columbia and the author of the book The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Welcome to the show.
Pleased to be here.
We started this conversation among our staff about kind of what's the cost of convenience. You have written about this and thought about this. Now, I guess I'd like to put it to you. When we think about societal convenience, where do those costs come in?
You know, it's a really interesting and paradoxical point. Most of the last 100 years, all of our technological efforts have been dedicated to making things more convenient. And the basic idea is that just saves people time and money. You know, writing a letter as opposed to writing an email is much faster and easier to write. And so it seems like there should be no cost for convenience. It should be all gains. Yet something strange has happened where most of us spend hours and hours writing emails. And there's a weird logic where sometimes when you make things easier or more convenient, we then get the idea we can do way more of them. And then we also expect way more of them ourselves. And you end up with what I call a tyranny of tiny tasks, where you spend your whole life with things that are individually easy, but you just have thousands of them. And that is one of the costs of convenience.
You have written about this in The New Yorker, about convenience and technology, and there was something where you said, we make ourselves into what we as a species will become mainly through our choices as consumers. What do you mean?
What I'm suggesting there is that we are always, we are very eager to seek out to make things easier for ourselves or more comfortable, but sometimes that has a net bad effect on us. And I'll give you an example. I mean, the most obvious example is we like food that's easy to get at and doesn't require any effort to chase down. And that's one of the reasons we have problems with obesity, is you think in much, like hundreds of years ago, if you had to actually go out and chase your food, that was a natural
like literally
kind of,
chase
yes,
your food.
No, I mean yes. It. Or you had to actually literally farm it, that was a built-in workout. So no one was worried about having a workout. So there's often these hidden costs of easiness or hidden costs of convenience, but we rarely factor them in. We almost always take the easiest, softest route for most things. There are some people who are really hard on themselves, but most of us, I just do the easy way.
Give me an example then. You've talked about screens, I know, that they kind of take over our brains. And yet at the same time, I can get a lot of stuff done, right? I can lie in bed and get 5 emails off to the staff here and get prepared for this interview.
Yeah,
how is that not helpful?
This is complicated. You know, the fact we have screens with us all the time, almost as a part of our body, you would think would make us better because we're more productive. We can do work whenever we want. And so you think maybe we'd be able to work less because we're more productive. But for some reason, it doesn't work that way. It turns out to be the opposite. And there's a logic to it I think we haven't fully figured out. Why is it we have all these technologies, these screens make us so much more productive? You're able to like do work while you're standing in line. Yet instead of our work hours decreasing, they've increased. And so something's upside down, and you add the fact that women have joined the workplace over the last 40 years and still everyone works more. And so the calculation is something is broken.
Let's look at it from the other end. We're a personal finance show. We like to sort of think about agency and what a person can do. So let's go the other way. What can you do if you're just one person or you're a parent and you're thinking, man, this is just costing me too much either money or mental bandwidth. I don't want my kid exposed to this. What do you do?
I think it's very important to think about attention as something you spend the same way you spend money. The weird thing about money is you know when you're spending it.
Yeah.
Well, credit card kind of disguises it, but you sort of know when you're spending
it. Oh, you've been listening.
But when you spend attention on something, you don't realize that you might just, oh, you know, I just surfed the web for 4 hours and okay. It kind of goes out. But like money, when you spend too much of it, you can end up in kind of attention bankruptcy. You can get overworked. You can kind of, you become sort of a crazy person. You can't concentrate. You can't do things. And so I think in the future, people will need to think about their attention as something they spend or conserve the same way they deal with money. And you'll start to, you maybe even have people have a budget. Like, I only budget this much attention to advertising a week or something like that. And I think that might be where we're going, particularly in the future where everything else we kind of have and all that's left is sort of time and attention.
One last thing I want to get into with you is this question of technological evolution. First, I would like you to define what that means.
That's just the idea that because our technologies are moving faster than biology right now, who we are as a species is becoming defined by our technology changes more than our biological changes. You know, it could be in another million years we'll have four arms or something, but it's kind of too slow. We'll have four robot arms first. That's the idea.
Is technological evolution something that has a connotation, positive, negative, attached to it? If we're talking about this cost of convenience.
Right. Well, the tech industry and our kind of American spirit has always been the newest thing is the greatest, and we can't really go wrong. We want to have the most capacities possible. Every new invention, whether it's Google Glass, the iPhone, the car, is a good thing leading us in a good direction. I don't know. You know, when we're stewards of our own evolution, I think we have to be a lot more careful because nature is smart in a way. If something doesn't work, the animal dies. While with us, if something doesn't work, well, I guess eventually we die, but we can make really bad kind of decisions in the short term and leave ourselves in a place where we have higher levels of technology, but less satisfaction, less happiness, distracted lives, or just not more of what we want. And so I think we are uncertain masters of our own destiny.
Tim Wu, author of The Master Switch, thank you so much.
Oh, it's been great being here.
We love to gather reflections on how your family shapes financial habits. This week, we hear from a man who's been part of one of the most successful television runs in history.
My name is Michael Price. I'm a writer and a co-executive producer on The Simpsons. I grew up in a town called South Plainfield, New Jersey. When I was growing up, at least, it was a very solid, middle-class, blue-collar town. My dad worked for a heavy construction firm. My mom was a housewife for most of her life, and then as we got older and we started going to college to help pay for college, she started working. So she ended up becoming a tire and battery salesman at Sears Auto Center on Route 22 in Watchung, New Jersey, where she was really great. You know, I always had sort of an aspiration or a dream to do what I do now in some way. I loved TV as a kid. I just watched TV all the time. I didn't really know that that was a thing that you could do in terms of making it instead of just watching it. But I loved theater. I loved acting. And as I got closer to graduating from high school, I made it clear to my parents that I wanted to major in theater. They didn't discourage me, but they encouraged me to be more practical. So I remember very clearly going to see a production of Man of La Mancha at a community theater in North Brunswick, New Jersey, down the road from us. And the guy who was playing Don Quixote, we read his bio, and it said, you know, he's a doctor during the day, but, you know. So I remember my mom leaning over to me and pointing to the thing and saying, see, he's a doctor during the day, and he does his acting at night. You know? So very, very nicely and gently saying that might be something you want to do. You know, do something that is a real job during the day, and then you can have your acting and your fun at night. I think it was because they loved us and they didn't want us to be disappointed. They never said don't do it, never said that. But I think they worried. Like, I would worry. You know, I'm a dad now, so I think I would feel the same way worrying about my son. I chased my dream, and I got it. I'm one of the few, lucky few that got it. And my wife, her name is Monica Holloway. She's an author who writes books. She got there, too. You know, so we want to be able to encourage him to do whatever he wants and to go for it. But I understand that, you know, I'll probably feel the same sort of pangs of, like, I hope it's okay. I hope he's all right. I think I understand better now where my parents were coming from when, you know, when they were sort of trying to gently guide me to sort of prepare a plan B in case what you want to do doesn't work out.
Find out more about Michael Price at marketplacemoney.org. That's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, yeah, it's that time of year, we're going to help with financial spring cleaning. Marketplace Money is produced by Candace Manriquez, Raghu Manavalan, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our senior producer is Dan Semitovich. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Thanks for listening.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.